Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome back one of our great guest co-hosts, Dr. Jamila Battle. Welcome back, Jamila.
Welcome.
It's really great to have you back on the show, and we're going to actually have some great conversations today talking about Stories to Save Lives Project with Rachel Seidman, director of UNC's Southern Oral History Program, and Joanna Ramirez, a master's student in global public health. Really looking forward to these conversations about people's beliefs about healthcare.
It sounds like we are going to have exciting conversations around some interesting stories.
You think everyone has a belief about healthcare?
Oh, absolutely.
We'll probably hear from our experts today on that. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters. And let's dive right in. Our very first research is about relationships that are on again and off again. And does that lead to higher rates of adverse, bad mental health? Were you ever in a relationship that was on again or off again?
Yeah, when I was young and in high school, you know.
Young and reckless.
Young love.
Yeah, I kind of like, yeah, first person date was 1 year, then 2 years, and 3 years, and all of a sudden I got married, and I've been married 33 years, so I didn't have too many of those on and getting off again, but apparently it's pretty frequent. And the question is, from these researchers at the University of Missouri, is there something more to it that could be actually bad for your health?
Well, prior research has estimated that more than 60% of adults have been involved in these on and off relationships, and more than one third of cohabiting couples report breaking up and later reconciling at some point, and that these relationships are often associated with higher rates of abuse, poor communication, and lower levels of commitment.
Yeah, and this current study, they actually looked at data from 500 individuals who are currently in relationships and interviews and looking at their breaking up and getting back together and then looking at how those events may be related, and found that they were significantly associated. The more you had those type of episodes, the more you had psychological distress like anxiety and depression. It didn't really matter if it's a same-sex or a heterosexual relationship. And that, I guess, is concerning, though I'm not fully certain what to make of it.
And I don't think they really knew what to make of it either. But they did say that partners that break up and reunite for a number of reasons, and the common ones were necessity or practicality, and that partners should get back together based on dedication, not obligation.
Yeah, I like that, though I think it's complicated, right? And certainly there's lots of factors going into it, which probably is why they're getting back together and breaking up and getting back together and breaking up there. I think the key point is, and I like what they said, is if it's okay to end a toxic relationship. I like that. You know, if it's not working, it's not working. This is in the journal Family Relations, Coming Out and Getting Back in Relationship Cycling and Distress and Same and Different Sex Relationships. I like the research, even though I don't understand it fully. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, about the vaccination rates for HPV vaccination against one of the more common causes of cervical cancer. Those rates are going up, but the bad news is that HPV-related cancer rates are rising. What's going on here, Jamila?
Well, it looks like basically we're moving in the right direction, but we're just not moving there fast enough. Apparently, half of adolescents ages 13 to 17 in 2017 had received all the recommended doses for HPV, while two-thirds had received just the first dose. And this, for both groups, that was a 5% point increase from the previous year. However, it sounds like HPV being most common sexually transmitted disease, with this affecting over 80 million Americans, it sounds like we've got the rise of throat cancer, which is one of the HPV-related malignancies.
So we're not vaccinating quick enough to stem the tide. And so just for our listeners, if you have someone who should get a HPV vaccination, and that would be children ages 11 to 12, should get two doses of it, 6 to 12 months apart. And those who get the first dose after the 15th birthday should get three shots. This can be life-saving. Don't put it off.
Don't put it off.
Finally, our last research that matters is there probably is not a safe level of alcohol consumption as we would commonly think about it across the world. This is pretty definitive research.
And this research was in the Lancet Journal, done by, it looks like, the University of Washington. And what they found in this study is that what we previously thought with moderate drinking and lower risk of heart disease, in fact, is not the truth, but alcohol use increases the risk for breast cancer, larynx cancer, strokes, cirrhosis, tuberculosis, self-harm, transportation accidents, and interpersonal violence.
Yeah, this was 512 researchers from 243 institutions really across the world looking at over 1,000 alcohol studies from 195 countries over the last almost 30 years. And the reality basically is at every really level of alcohol consumption, there is more harm. At low levels, it's low. So if you have a drink a day, it might raise your risk for one of 23 conditions by 0.5%. Mm-hmm. If you drink two drinks a day, it's 7%. And at five drinks a day, it's 37% higher. Now, you might ask, who drinks five or more drinks a day?
The heaviest drinking nation was Romania, where men on average consume 8.2 drinks a day.
These are serious problems, and I think people need to hear the information so they can decide what they want to do. Well, that'll conclude the Research Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue with a conversation with Dr. Rachel Seidman, director of UNC's Southern Oral History Program, talking about stories to save lives, documenting North Carolinians' beliefs about healthcare. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamila, we're talking with Dr. Rachel Seidman, director of the University of North Carolina's Southern Oral History Program, and Joanna Ramirez, a master's student in the Geeling School of Global Public Health, about Stories to Save Lives Project, Diverse Beliefs About Healthcare. Welcome, Dr. Seidman and Ms. Ramirez.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, we're so excited to have you here because I think what you're really going to help us understand are the things that I know Jamila and I are passionate about, which is narratives and how they explain experience. Mm-hmm. First, before we dive right in there, help us to understand your experience. How did you get to the place where you're interested in these types of historical and contemporaneous narratives? Maybe start with you, Dr. Seidman.
Well, for me, it really started with a phone call from Dr. Ross Simpson, who is a cardiologist at the University of North Carolina. He runs something called the Sudden Project. He studies sudden death. And he called me one day and he said, I've been studying sudden death in North Carolina for about 5 years. These are people who drop dead outside of the hospital. He said, I know a lot about them after they die. I've looked at their medical records, their death certificates, but I don't know much about them when they were alive. And that makes it very difficult for me to develop effective interventions. Do you think oral history could help me? And I was so struck by this doctor who was calling a historian to ask for help. I said, I really don't know, but let's find out. So the Sudden Project and the Southern Oral History Program applied together for a FIRE grant, a Fostering Interdisciplinary Research grant, to find out what did we have in the oral histories archive. We have an archive of 6,000 interviews that have been collected since the 1970s with people all across the South. What did we already have in our archive that might help him understand particularly rural Southerners' attitudes toward health care, their beliefs about health care, their worries, their concerns? And so we spent about a year digging into our archive to see what was already there. What we discovered was we had a lot of great anecdotes, but researchers had not really focused on these questions. And so in many cases, there would be a short story or something, and then the interviewer would move on. So I decided that I really wanted the oral history program to delve more deeply into these questions because they are so much at the core of problems that are facing the country today. And I thought that maybe we could really play an important role.
And what about you, Ms. Maris?
So in undergrad, I was an English and pre-med double major. So narratives in healthcare is literally everything that I'm passionate about. So I was with a friend and we were at some event. I don't even remember what the event was, but Rachel, Dr. Seidman, was there and she talked about, you know, this very exciting collaboration between public health and oral histories. And we pestered her until she came up with this project, summer pilot program for Stories to Save Lives, which is what we're here to talk about today. And our project was to go to a rural clinic and just talk to people about what does healthcare mean? What does it mean to be healthy? What does it matter that you're in a rural place in North Carolina versus, you know, an urban place? I feel Chapel Hill is relatively urban. So it was just a very interesting project to be able to talk about health and healthcare and find those stories that I feel are missing when you talk to doctors. And even in public health, sometimes the narrative gets a little lost when you're looking at data and figures and statistics. And it's very important to bring it back to the individual because individuals can tell stories that reflect, mm-hmm. you know, larger themes and motives and things that are happening.
So speaking of themes, what are some of the larger themes that you saw in these collection of stories?
Well, so when we looked in the older stories, that many of them dated back to the 1970s and 80s, some of the themes that came out were about the relationships between individuals and their doctors. And we really noticed moments where people recalled doctors, even doctors they had had 50 or 60 years earlier, by name, and the sort of intense personal relationships that they had had with these doctors versus some more recent interviews where people often referred to healthcare providers as they, particularly when they felt that information was just kind of being unloaded on them or they were being given directions that they had to follow, but there wasn't much back and forth communication. So there were interesting themes that emerged also around the notion of whether or not people felt a sense of self-efficacy and how much control they did or didn't have over their own health care. These are some of the issues that we set out to explore in more depth today. And then, Joanna, you found new themes also emerging in the interviews.
Yeah, so like I said, we were in rural North Carolina. So a lot of the themes that came up were related to people who grew up in rural North Carolina. And specifically, the clinic that we were working at has a really high retention rate for providers that are either from the area or that were from the area, moved away and moved back, or that moved there intending to stay for a short period of time and then ended up just staying there. So it was really fascinating to hear kind of how community plays into health and healthcare providers and receiving care. We also talked about home remedies. It came up a lot. How do you find healthcare and when do you go to a doctor? So those conversations about how do you decide when it's time to go to a doctor, specifically when you're in a rural area and the doctor might not be nearby. So how has that been passed down from generation to generation? And for us, it was an interesting to see the flip side, to see them talking about their parents and like how heavily they relied on home remedies and how they can remember using home remedies or having home remedies, you know, done when they were growing up, and then they're moved towards going to the doctor and what does it mean to go to a doctor and the kind of health care that they would like to receive.
So let's take a listen to one of these stories. Let's hear from Miss Parker. And I understand that she had an experience talking about her doctor and what it meant to her.
But now, if they had a patient that was sick, I mean really sick, why, they'd sit with them all night.
Was he the only doctor here for a long time?
Yeah.
And so, well, what was the quality of medical care? Dr. Bowerly and Miss Bick were pretty much all the town had.
Yeah, but you got good medical care because you got all that personal attention that you don't get today.
Ms. Parker is from Coulomie, North Carolina, and she was interviewed back in the 1970s as part of a set of interviews with people who moved from rural areas, agricultural areas, to work in the textile mills in North Carolina. And so she's talking about doctors who served a particular textile mill community in that time.
What I find fascinating about her story is this power of the doctor really committing themselves to the patient, staying with the patient all night if that's what it took. This wasn't about, oh, my shift is up. The shift hour is here. Oh, you know, I've got to be somewhere else. And you don't hear that as much, but I know in my field, in family medicine, I do hear stories. I hear the story of the doctor who stayed there in the labor room with that patient who was having a difficult labor. Does that resonate as powerful to listeners as it sounds?
I certainly found in these interviews that people feeling that they were being listened to and not rushed and really heard was almost at the core of what they defined as good healthcare, more than the outcomes, more than the technology, more than almost anything else, was really oftentimes the first thing people talked about was whether or not that doctor stayed long enough and asked the right questions to really get to know them and to understand them.
And what about you, Joanna?
Yes, so we interviewed many providers at this clinic. So it was really interesting to hear them talk about their experience in healthcare as a patient before they were a provider or after they were a provider, and how that actually influenced either how they performed healthcare themselves or how they sought healthcare for themselves. So it was definitely very interesting to hear time and time again, just, I want somebody who listens to me, who's somebody who takes me seriously, somebody who cares about what I have to say, somebody who actually takes the time. So I feel like there is this shift into that's what we want. We want that individualized healthcare.
We want to hear more of these stories and narratives, but we do need to take a short break. And when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Rachel Seidman, director of the University of North Carolina's Southern Oral History Program, and Joanna Ramirez, a master's student in the UNC School of Global Public Health, about the Stories to Save Lives project. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Rachel Seidman, director of the University of North Carolina's Southern Oral History Program, and Joanna Ramirez, a master's student in the School of Public Health, about the Stories to Save Lives project. And right before the break, we heard this really powerful story, narrative, an older narrative from Ms. Parker, talking about the value of listening and being there with the patient. And you mentioned, Joanna, right before the break about interviews with some providers. And there's an interview I know you have with the provider, Dr. Sabra Hammond, that really, I think, speaks to how the doctor is maybe conflicted about what's happening and things that you as a patient may not hear. Let's listen to that for a second.
I rarely have an appointment with a patient where cost does not become part of the discussion. And it's not only disheartening, it's stressful. We forget, we watched doctors on TV. That's another thing. Where did my medical culture come from? It came from watching medical programs on TV when I was a kid. Okay. We watch those programs on TV and we know that they're all over-dramatized and this and that. But in the office, in the day-to-day, it's very easy to forget that medicine really is life and death, and that while the opportunities to save someone every day don't come along every day, and you never do it by yourself, the opportunity to kill someone through a careless decision or a bad decision happens every single day. It's serious business, and it is appropriately stressful. The fact that I have to juggle all of my decisions with cost factors in mind takes something that is appropriately stressful and makes it into something that is inappropriately stressful. And then we multiply that times the documentation quota that goes along with our proving that we're doing medical care, which completely distorts the process from charting what's important to charting what Medicare and Medicaid have said give you enough points in order to be reimbursed. And so it takes a job that is an art and a science, and it turns it into bean counting tinged with fear for your patient because of the cost.
What makes it worthwhile?
When I can help someone and when I can connect with people.
Boy, that is disheartening, because there's this balance of, I guess, having to think about cost. And sometimes I really don't want to think about those things.
How did that play out in any of the interviews? Was there dismay about where we're at in medicine today? So much concern about knowing the responsibility you have about life and death decisions?
It did come up, and it was interesting to see some kind of dichotomy between the older providers and the newer providers, and also between the direct caregivers, so the CNAs and the doctors who might not have been there the entire time. And so what was interesting to me was talking to them about how they see healthcare and how they see, you know, what does it mean to be a provider. And we did have another doctor who talked about, you know, I have always worked with rural communities, and to me, what's important is working with the individual patient, also working in family medicine and being able to be with families time and time and time again, and just like kind of being there throughout the entire process. And that just seemed to be very important to a lot of the providers that were there at the clinic. And even the CNAs, we had multiple stories, and they could recall with detail all of the different patients that they've had, and they just had so many rich narratives about their experiences, and they were just so passionate about how important it was to them to make those decisions in the best interest of their patients. And that was what they were passionate about, and that was why they were there. And even though some of them had worked in more urban areas, that they returned to the rural areas because they saw that need, and that there were, you know, pros and cons to every decision that you make, but at the heart of their decisions was, we want to do what's best for the patients.
You know, Dr. Simon, we know today that the CNA is a certified nursing assistant. It's not the physician in the room. It's the team that comes in the room and the teams that are visiting patients in their homes. And I know there's a story that you have from Ruth McKeitham, a CNA, who experienced prejudice in the room or in the visits with patients. Tell us a little bit about that, and then maybe we'll hear the story. Why was that an important narrative?
Well, I was really struck by this because I think, you know, those of us who are interested in these issues we're getting used to hearing stories about how the racism of doctors can affect the outcomes for patients. But I think we less often hear stories about the racism of the patients and the impact that that can have on the providers. And Ruth McKeithen, who's a Black woman, really exhibits an incredible amount of patience and grace in the way that she handles these interactions and in the way that she thinks about them and offers the patients a chance almost at reconciliation, in a sense, by the end of her visits with them.
Let's take a quick listen to that story.
And like when in my older years, I started working with patients, and you work with old white people, and they still prejudiced because they was raised that way. And before you leave, they're hugging you and kissing you and telling you they love you. You know, when you walk in there, they spit on you, they call you this. And then before it's all over, they're hugging you and they're kissing you. You know, okay.
What do you think causes that change?
They see me. They see me. They see it's bad in everybody, but they saw the good in me, regardless of what color I was. And it's good in all of us. And they seen that, you know, they seen that. And especially when they can go to there and spit on you. Okay. You know, that spit is nasty, but you take it because, you know, Lord forgive them. They know not what they done. And you wipe that spit off and you go back in there, you know. The culture, I call you. But you'll be okay. My mama, you know, had always something, what don't make you, it'll break you. So it made me strong, and I just stayed right there. And when you get ready to leave, come here, Ruth, give me a kiss, let me give a hug. That makes it okay. You know, because it's good in all of us.
I can certainly relate to this as a Black woman who's also a physician. And the best comeback to that is handling that with grace, as you mentioned.
You know, these are such powerful stories. And I wonder also the name of this project, the Stories to Save Lives. Why that name? What does it mean to you? And what are you hoping that it means to listeners around the country?
Well, we came up with that name in conversation with Dr. Ross Simpson, that we were really hoping that these narratives that we would collect could actually help providers, doctors, researchers understand the ways that people were thinking about their health, who they trusted, where they got information from, all of the complexities in their lives, so that doctors and providers who were either talking to patients or designing interventions in public health settings would have new kinds of information at their fingertips so that these interventions would be more effective and might actually help save lives.
It seems like that's one of the biggest challenges in healthcare today. I'm not having the time to uncover the story that can give us such a wealth of information. What are some of the maybe successes?
There's some really interesting projects going on around the country. There's one that comes out of Wisconsin but is being implemented here at the VA hospital, where interviewers go around in the hospital and they ask patients who, you know, may be staying there for an extended period of time, would you like to do an oral history with us while you're sitting here? If the patient agrees, they'll sit down and do an hour or so long life history of the person, which might include their service, but it might also be a longer life history interview. And then they actually type a condensed version of that up, and it goes into their medical record so that the nurses or the doctors who come in can actually read that life history of that person, which can at the very least provide a way to break the ice and start a conversation, but may actually explicate some really important themes or patterns in this person's life over time.
I saw a patient just the other day that at the end of the visit, first time I had seen this patient, they described a shrapnel injury from a civil war in a Latin American country when they were a child. This life-defining event, where many people in their village were wiped out, was not in the medical record. I knew nothing of it, but yet it defined so much about this person's care. And another patient I saw that was a problem list on there was a nerve agent in World War II, exposure to a nerve agent in World War II. Mm. There's a diagnosis for that, yeah. But there's not the history and the understanding of what that experience might mean. I can't tell you how thankful I am for you all helping us understand the importance of these narratives. Do you each have a final thought that you would like our listeners to take away from your experiences with patients and providers? What about you, Joanna?
I think just listening to other people, whether that's your provider, whether that's your neighbor, your family member, your mother, your grandmother, your children. I think it's very important to listen to the stories and kind of get to know how narratives define our lives. And medicine isn't just about, you know, signs and symptoms. It's about the individual and where they come from and where they're going.
What about you, Dr. Simon?
Well, I agree with what Joanna is saying, listening, and also being sure that when the time is right that you tell your story and that you advocate for yourself and make sure that whatever information you think it's important that the doctor or the nurse understand about you, it might be something that seems irrelevant to the topic at hand, but if it's important to you, it's important to get across to them, I think. And also, I do want our listeners to know that the interviews at the Southern Oral History Program are available online, and anyone anywhere in the world can listen to these interviews. And you may be interested in health, but you may be interested in many other topics like the civil rights movement or the women's movement, and they're all there for you to listen to. So we're happy to share those.
Well, we're so happy. We'll put links to those. I think you've given us a roadmap to the future. We're going to leave this segment hearing from one of your interviews, from William Sessions, talking about his story. And with that, we want to say thank you to both of us for being our guests today on Your Health.
Thank you for having us.
How would you define health and being healthy?
Being healthy is being well, feeling well, and being able to operate well physically, mentally, and spiritually.
And what kind of health care helps get you there?
All of it, from the dental to the optometry. Everything plays a part.
And what do you think is necessary for us to improve on health care?
What is necessary for us to improve health care is to cater patient care to the lifestyle and culture of the individual. Instead of statistics, instead of research, formula, and all of that, which are good, and we can't do away with that, but sometimes let's come up with a plan that's based off of who you are and what it is that you do from day to day. Because 9 times out of 10, who you are and what you do from day to day has a lot to do with why you are feeling what you're feeling.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, it's yourhealth@unc.edu. I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I began having foot pain a few weeks ago. I've sort of self-diagnosed plantar fasciitis. It's becoming quite painful, however. Should I go see my physician, or can I just treat it myself?
A lot of people really can self-diagnose. So we actually have two issues going on here. One is the ability to self-diagnose what's mm-hmm. going on here. And plantar fasciitis is the number one kind of probably cause of kind of generalized foot pain. Mm-hmm. But one thing people don't realize is that, taught to me by a wise podiatrist who said 90% of foot problems, Adam, are because of the shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Not
that
because
makes
of the
sense.
Feet. And you go look at the shoes and you see shoes that are really worn out. You see someone who walks on the heel and that heel worn out, and you see a shoe that has very poor arch support. So frequently the shoe needs to have something done to it, whether it's a new shoe or a shoe with good arch support or getting mm-hmm. orthotics put into the shoe, something that redistributes weight. I love stretching exercises. I love stretching exercises for the feet. Who doesn't like massage? So I think a lot of times there are really simple things one can do to try first about some stretching exercise. People take a towel, put it around their toes and kind of stretch out the foot there. They get these balls that you can roll on, and way before you get to things like tape, way before you get to things like medication.
Mm-hmm.
Those things, they're good, but really the solution is really trying to prevent these things and then catching them early with proper footwear.
Gotcha.
What's our very next house call, Laura?
I am a woman in my 60s. I've been taking the same medication for my blood pressure for several years. This week I went to see my doctor and he said there was a voluntary recall on my medication and that he wanted to switch my pill. Is that really necessary? What's the risk either way?
Well, there was a high blood pressure medication called Valsartan. A couple months ago, there were impurities that they found, some processes in the manufacturing and the drug, and so they were getting into the drug. And so these things were recalled by the Food and Drug Administration. And we, as providers, got lots of phone calls from our patients with these medications. And it was really quite easy to put patients on a different medication because these things called angiotensin receptor blockades, these ARBs, A-R-B, there are different medications that are, you know, they're first cousins. They're almost identical cousins. Not quite identical, but, you know, they're close enough that you can switch from one to the other safely. And we were able to do that. We didn't have to go to a different class of medications with a different class of side effects. So the side effects should have been relatively the same. The doses might have changed. I don't think they've really understood how the impurities got into some of the manufacturing. And so there are quite a few that were recalled. They recalled all of them just so it was, you know, to understand. And I suspect that this will eventually be cleared and the product will be back on the market. I think in general, if they're recalling the product, it probably is a good sign that, you know, probably shouldn't take it. But on the same token, I think your provider can quickly reassure you about the alternatives. And there, again, in this case, there were lots of alternatives. So hopefully you can reassure our listener. What's our very last house call?
I have trouble sleeping several nights a week. Once I get to sleep, it seems to be okay, but I do think I could get better sleep. My sister recommended melatonin. She said it really helped her to fall asleep and feel more rested during the day. What do you think about taking melatonin, and do you know of any risks or interactions?
So melatonin in the United States is regulated essentially as a over-the-counter, and it's a supplement. So it really isn't highly regulated. And so really people can get it in lots of different doses and lots of different ways there. It's important that as we begin to learn about melatonin, I mean, it's a natural hormone involved in our rhythm of sleep and wakefulness. And it's actually 10 times higher when you go to sleep than when you're daytime.
So that's significant.
But it becomes less on your system as you age, which is one of the reasons why people who are older have a more difficult time sleeping, because the regulation of that melatonin seems to be more difficult. What we're really starting to also find out is that the doses that people need to take are not the doses that sometimes people are out there taking. They may be thinking, oh, I need to take the 3 milligrams two times a day, when in reality, you might be really good to use a very low dose, a 0.1 to 0.5 or 0.3 milligram dose at bedtime. That's called a physiologic dose because that's more what's occurring naturally in your system. If you take a dose 10 times higher, you're going to get the amount in your bloodstream 10 times more than what you might normally have, which leads to possible side effects. What do you think a side effect of a drug that helps you promote sleep might be if you get too much of it?
Drowsiness,
confusion,
okay.
What we call central nervous system side effects. So we really want to avoid those things. And so people will sometimes use the melatonin to kind of reset that rhythm, maybe sometimes for jet lag. But I would encourage them to do it in the smallest dose that they really need, which is probably lower than what most people are using.
Do they come in doses that small, or do you have to like kind of cut the pill in half
usually you can look for the smaller doses.
Right dose.
A lot of times people will be marketing the higher doses
right.
because that's what maybe get a little more money.
So you have to be a savvy consumer.
You have to be a savvy consumer, yeah. Well, that'll conclude our house call today. And we want to thank all of our guests for joining us today for your health. And we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us for your health. If you want to follow us, you can follow us at yourhealthradio.org. You can listen to us and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. And we'd like to thank our guests today, Dr. Rachel Seidman and Joanna Ramirez. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.